George Speaks and Friends and Brothers by Dick King Smith. Read by Nigel Lambert. George Speaks. Chapter 1. Laura's baby brother George was 4 weeks old when it happened. Laura, who was 7, had very much wanted a brother or sister for a long time. "It'd be so nice to have someone to play with," she thought. But when George was born, she wasn't so sure. Everybody, her mother and father, the grandparents, uncles, aunts, friends, made such a fuss of him. And all of them said how beautiful he was. Laura didn't think he was. How could anyone with a round red face and a squashy nose and little tiny eyes all sunken in fat be called beautiful? She looked at him as he lay asleep in his carry cot. "Don't wake George up, will you?" her mother had said. "I'll be in the kitchen if you want me." "I won't wake you," Laura said to the sleeping baby. "And I don't want to sound rude, but I must tell you something. You look just like a little pig." And that was when it happened. The baby opened his eyes and stared straight at her.
"Pig yourself," he said.
Laura gasped. A shiver ran up her spine and her toes tingled.
What did you say?
She whispered.
"I said, pig yourself,"
said George.
"You're not deaf, are you?"
No, said Laura.
"No, it's just that I didn't expect you to say anything." "Why not?"
"Well, babies don't say proper words. They only make noises, like goo-goo or blubla or wah."
"Is that a fact?"
said the baby.
"Yes,"
said Laura.
"It is. However can you talk like that when you're only 4 weeks old? It's amazing. I must run and tell Mum."
She turned to dash out of the room.
"Laura,"
said the baby sharply. Laura turned back.
"Yes, George,"
she said. The baby looked at her very severely, his forehead creased into a little frown.
"On no account are you to tell our mother,"
he said.
"Or anyone else, for that matter. This is a secret between you and me. Do you understand?"
Yes, George,
said Laura.
"I've been waiting for some time now,"
said George,
"to speak to you on your own. This is the first proper chance I've had, what with feeding and bathing and nappy changing and people coming to see me all the time. And talk about making noises. That's all some of them do. They bend over me with silly grins on their faces, and then they come out with a load of rubbish. Who's Boofledin? Who's a gorgeous, gorgeous, porgeous? Diddums, wassums, grannies, ickle treasure? It's an insult to the English language."
"But, George,"
said Laura,
"how do you know the English language?"
"Well, I'm English, aren't I?"
"Yes, but how did you learn it?"
"Same way as you, I imagine. Listening to grown-ups talking. I wasn't born yesterday, you know."
"But you're only 4 weeks old,"
said Laura.
"How did you learn so quickly?"
"I'm a quick learner,"
said George. He waved his little arms and kicked his pudgy legs in the air.
"Talking's a piece of cake,"
he said.
"Trouble is, I haven't learned to control my body very well yet. In fact, I'm afraid we'll have to postpone the rest of this conversation until another time."
"Why?"
asked Laura.
"I'm wet,"
said George.
"Oh,"
said Laura.
"Shall I go and tell Mummy you need changing?"
"Use your brains, Laura,"
said George.
"You couldn't have known unless I told you, could you? You keep quiet. I'll tell her."
"But you said it was going to be a secret between the two of us, you being able to talk, I mean."
"So it is,"
said George.
"I'll tell her in the way she expects. I've got her quite well trained."
And he shut his eyes and yelled,
"Wah! Wah! Wah!"
at the top of his voice. His mother came in.
"What the matter with Mummy's lubby ickle lammy?"
she said. She picked George up and felt him.
Oh, he's soaking,
she said.
No wonder he was crying. Poor Pettykins.
She smiled at Laura as she changed the baby's nappy.
It's the only way they can let you know there's something wrong, isn't it?
She said.
Yes, Mummy,
said Laura. She caught George's eye as he lay across his mother's lap. It was no surprise to her that he winked. Chapter 2. For the rest of that day, Laura was in a state of great excitement. She kept grinning to herself and hugging herself and doing little dances when no one was looking. Fancy having a baby brother who could talk.
Think of all the things we can talk about,
she thought.
What a lot there'll be for me to tell him. Or will there?
She watched George being bathed, kicking away just like any other small baby, while his mother supported his head with one hand and with the other flicked the warm water over his sticking-out tummy.
I shouldn't be surprised,
thought Laura.
If there's nothing I can tell him, he probably knows it all already. He looks clever, doesn't he, Mum?
She said.
Clever?
Said her mother, laughing. Why, he's only a baby, Laura. Babies don't know anything.
But he's booful, aren't you, my little ooky-pooky poppet?
Gurgle glug, said George.
Laura didn't get a chance to be alone with George before bedtime, but she spent the whole night, it seemed, dreaming about him. In one of these dreams, she took him to school with her and carried him into assembly.
Laura,
said the headmaster,
that child is far too young to come to school.
But, sir,
said Laura,
he's very intelligent.
Intelligent, is he?
Said the headmaster, while all the children laughed.
I suppose he knows his tables.
Of course,
Laura said. The headmaster leaned down towards the baby, who was sitting on Laura's lap.
Well, young man, he said, perhaps you could tell me the answer to this. What's 3 times 9?
27,
said George. He looked scornfully at the headmaster.
I would have expected you to know that,
he said. When Laura woke up next morning and remembered that dream, it seemed fantastic. Fantastic to think that a tiny baby could do sums. Or talk, for that matter. Was that all a dream? What she thought had happened yesterday?
I must make sure,
she said, and she jumped out of bed. Peeping round the door of George's room, she saw that he was alone. Mummy was downstairs getting breakfast, and Daddy was shaving in the bathroom. Laura went in, closing the door behind her, and looked into the cot.
George,
she said softly.
It's me, Laura. Listen, George. What's 3 times 9?
George smiled at her and waved his fat little hands.
Go, go,
he said.
Go, go, go.
Laura's face crumpled. It had all been a dream then. She burst into tears.
Oh, come on, Laura,
said George testily.
Don't be such a baby.
Oh, George,
cried Laura, the tears running down her face. She bent over and kissed the top of his bald head.
I thought,
she said,
I thought...
I know what you thought,
said George.
Can't you take a joke? And do stop crying on me. It's bad enough being wet at the bottom end.
Sorry,
sniffed Laura.
The answer to your question,
said George,
is 27. Don't you know your tables?
Only 2 times and 10 times,
said Laura. George sighed.
I can see you're going to need some help,
he said.
Let's start with a 3 times table. Repeat after me.
And he began.
3 ones are 3.
They had just finished when the bedroom door suddenly opened and their father came in, rubbing his face with a towel.
You're a funny old thing, aren't you?
He said to Laura.
I don't know what you mean,
Laura said.
Well, I was standing outside listening to you saying your tables, and you said everything twice over.
I remember it better that way,
Laura said.
Blah, blah,
George said.
Anyway, you got them all right. I didn't know you knew your three times. Clever girl. Wonder if you'll be as clever when you're Laura's age, George.
Blah, blah, blah,
George said. Downstairs, the telephone rang.
It's for you,
their mother called, and their father went out of the room.
Golly, said Laura. We nearly gave the game away then. I didn't know Daddy had finished in the bathroom.
George smiled.
It was a close shave,
he said. Chapter 3. There weren't all that many chances, Laura found, to talk to George. If there wasn't a grown-up with him, then he was likely to be asleep. He slept a great deal. Once, Laura had woken him from an afternoon nap, and he'd been quite grumpy.
"Don't you understand," he'd said, "that I must have my 18 hours?"
But sometimes it all worked out just right. Like the sunny Saturday morning when their mother had put George in his pram and said to Laura, "Would you like to push him round the garden for a little while?"
"At last we're alone,"
said Laura in a dramatic voice, once they were as far as possible from the house.
"What's up?"
said George.
"You sound worried."
"I am,"
said Laura.
"I need your advice."
"Trouble with a three-times table again?"
said George.
"No, I know that. I was the only one in our class that did. My teacher at school was amazed."
"So is your other teacher,"
said George dryly.
"Anyway, what's eating you?"
"It's the grown-ups,"
Laura said.
"How are we going to stop them finding out about you? Daddy nearly did the other morning."
She glanced towards the house.
"Suppose Mummy sees my lips moving now,"
she said.
"So, you're talking to me,"
said George.
"People do talk to babies, endlessly. Sometimes they even wake them up to talk to them."
"Yes, but babies don't talk back,"
said Laura.
"Suppose someone came into a room and saw you talking."
"Well, that might be tricky,"
said George. He wrinkled his little forehead in thought. Then he smiled.
"Got it,"
he said.
"If that ever happens, you just pretend you're a ventriloquist."
"A what?"
George sighed.
"Oh, a ventriloquist,"
he said patiently,
"is someone who can throw his voice. He has a dummy on his lap, and he makes it seem as if the dummy is talking. I could be your dummy. You'd keep your lips quite still, and I'd say things like, 'A bottle of beer.'"
"Why?"
said Laura. George sighed again.
"Oh, forget it,"
he said.
"But I can't forget it, George,"
said Laura.
"This is what's worrying me. Here you are, only just born."
6 weeks today,
said George.
"And yet you know your tables and long words like ven... whatever it was, and exactly how old you are. Other babies can't do any of those things. How can you?"
"To be honest with you, Laura,"
said George in a serious voice,
"I don't know. All I can remember is looking around just after I arrived and finding everything very familiar. It was as though I'd seen it all before. There was a clock on the wall that said 4:30, and I thought, 'Tea time.' And there was a calendar with a date on it, 1st April. And I thought, 'What a day to be born on.' And a bit later on, I heard Mummy and Daddy talking. 'We must decide on a name,' he said. And she said, 'Well, we agreed it's either Frederick or Charles, didn't we?' And I was just going to say, 'Rubbish, I'm George,' when one of them said, 'What about George? It's a nice name.' And the other said, 'George, yes, I like that.' So I kept my mouth shut. Anyway, it would have been much too much of a shock for grown-ups. They don't have much imagination. But I couldn't resist letting you in on the secret."
"But how much longer can we keep it a secret?"
asked Laura.
Well, said George, they're going to have to know sooner or later. I can't take too much more of this goo, 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 blah, 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 wah stuff. It gets pretty boring. But I plan to take it gradually. Just the odd word to begin with, the kind of thing they expect. You know, ba-ba, da-da, more, that sort of level.
You're going to say things like that quite soon, you mean?
Said Laura.
That's right. Maybe it would be best to start off by repeating words that they say to me.
Like a parrot, you mean?
Yes,
said George.
Then, once I get them used to the idea that I'm an early developer, I can speed things up a bit. Feed them some simple sentences.
Like what?
George wriggled uncomfortably.
Like, George wants potty,
he said.
Shh,
said Laura suddenly.
Mummy's coming.
Okay, said George. There's no time like the present. Watch this.
He waited until his mother's face appeared, looking down into the pram, and then he stared up at her and smiled.
Mama!
Said George loudly.
Did you hear that, Laura?
She said in amazement.
Did you hear what George just said?
Yes, Mummy,
said Laura.
Only 6 weeks old, and he says, Mama. You heard him, didn't you?
Yes, Mummy.
You did say it, didn't you, baby?
Yes, Mummy,
said George. Chapter 4
George speaks!
Cried the children's mother, the moment their father came home from work.
What do you mean?
First of all, he said, Mama.
Well, that's just a noise a baby makes.
Ah, but then he said, Yes, Mummy. Didn't he, Laura? Laura had said to me, Yes, Mummy, and George repeated it.
Like a parrot, you mean?
Yes.
The children's father smiled.
It hardly sounds likely, he said dryly.
He went into the bedroom and bent over the cot.
Hello, George,
he said to the baby. And the baby replied,
Hello, George.
His father turned pale.
I can't believe it's true, he said.
It's true,
said George.
I don't think he can say a whole sentence yet, Daddy,
said Laura quickly.
Just two words at a time. Shall I have a go now?
She looked into the cot, trying hard not to giggle, and said,
How many words can you say, George?
Only two. Only two,
said George.
You see,
said Laura to her parents.
After all,
she said,
he's not very old, is he?
I simply don't believe my ears,
said her father to her mother.
Neither do I. What are we to do?
Her father mopped his brow.
I'm going to ring up the doctor,
he said, and they both went out of the room.
Golly,
said Laura.
What will you do now, George?
Take it easy, Laura,
said George. Again he wrinkled his little forehead in thought.
I think,
he said,
that we're going to have to slow things down a bit. That's the trouble with grown-ups. Something out of the ordinary happens and they panic. Children are so much more sensible.
But what will you say when the doctor comes?
George waved a fat hand towards his mouth.
Watch this space, he said.
Well, now, young fellow, said the doctor when he came. What's all this I hear?
George stared blankly up at him.
Only 6 weeks old and beginning to talk. You'll be in the Guinness Book of Records.
He turned to George's parents.
He repeated the actual words after you, did you see?
He asked.
Yes,
they said.
Well, well,
said the doctor in a jolly voice.
Let's see if he'll do it for me.
He bent down to George.
Good evening,
he said loudly and clearly. George remained silent.
The doctor smiled. Perhaps he knows he shouldn't talk to strangers, he said dryly. You have a go.
George's father cleared his throat nervously.
Hello, George, he said.
Go, 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 said George.
Speak to us, George, said his father.
Blah, 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 said George.
I'm afraid I call that perfectly ordinary baby talk, said the doctor.
Laura grinned at her brother.
Come on, George, she said. Say something to the nice doctor.
George smiled at his sister. Then he pursed up his little mouth and blew two loud, rude raspberries. The doctor looked narrowly at the children's parents.
Perhaps, he said, you've been overdoing things. Take a break. Have a holiday. And next time this infant makes a funny noise, just say to yourselves quite calmly, it is not possible for a baby to speak at the age of 6 weeks. Goodbye.
Chapter 5. In the weeks that followed, George treated his parents with care. They were not ready, it was plain to him, to grasp just how different he was from other babies.
No use expecting them to run before they can walk, he said to Laura.
So he kept on manfully with his baby talk, but threw in the occasional couple of parrot words as well to reassure them. They had agreed, after the doctor's visit, to keep George's gift a family secret. They didn't know of the long conversations that George and Laura had when alone. George made use of these talks to improve his lot. Speech and knowledge were his, but bodily control was not. For that, he would have to wait. But not as long, he determined, as an ordinary baby. He planned to improve matters with Laura's help. The first way was to use her as bookholder and page-turner. For reading, George was sure, would help to pass the long, boring hours of babyhood. They had to be careful in case someone came in. And Laura always had a big picture book ready to put over the top of whatever story George was reading to her. The second improvement, which George arranged, was in the matter of food.
Milk, milk, and more milk, he said to Laura. I'm fed up with the stuff. Next time we go down to the supermarket with Mummy, have a good look at the tinned baby foods. They're on a high shelf, and I can't read the labels from my pram. See what varieties they've got. Oh, I'd give my eye teeth for a change from milk, if I had any.
So, the next time they went shopping, Laura took a tin off the shelf and popped it into the trolley when her mother wasn't looking. What's this? Said her mother when they reached the checkout. Baby food? Minced beef and vegetables?
It's for George, Laura said.
But he's barely 2 months old, Laura. It's far too early to feed him solids. Put it back where you found it.
But, Mummy, said Laura, I'm sure he'll eat it.
Eat it, said George from the depths of his pram.
The checkout lady stared.
Do you know, she said, just for a second, I thought that that baby said something.
Blah, blah, blah,
said George. And thankfully and hastily, his mother put the tin of baby food down with the rest of her shopping, paid, and hurried out.
There's no way that a baby of George's age is going to eat this stuff, Laura, she said when they got home.
She tipped the minced beef and vegetables into a bowl.
He'll simply spit it out, she said.
She dipped a spoon into the bowl and held it to George's mouth.
He's just too young to think that it's nice, she said.
George gulped the spoonful down.
It's nice, he said.
After that, it was easy. George made a simple plan.
I'll choose the menu, he said to Laura, and tell you my choices. Then you say them to me, and I just repeat them.
So, at feeding times, Laura would say, in front of her mother,
What would you like, George? Bacon casserole?
And George would say,
Bacon casserole.
And for afters, Peach Melba.
Peach Melba.
Or it might be Chicken and Mushroom and Fruit Delight.
Chicken and Mushroom and Fruit Delight.
Sometimes, of course, Laura was at school, and then George just had to hope for the best. If he was very lucky, it might be his favourite mixture. Chocolate pudding on top of lamb hot pot. Taking pot luck, he called it. The third improvement that George wanted was to do with quite a different sort of pot.
Laura,
he said,
can you remember what it was like when you were in nappies?
No.
Lucky you, said George. I can tell you that it's most unpleasant. Potty training, training Mummy and Daddy to it, I mean, must begin as soon as possible.
But how will you balance, George?
Someone will have to hold me, that's obvious. But they'll be only too glad to if they can dispense with nappies. I just want you to help me break them into the idea, in the usual way. And then they'll be able to manage on their own.
In fact, his mother's training began that very day. George winked at Laura, and Laura said,
Mummy, do you think George would go on a pot?
A pot,
said George.
Don't be silly, Laura, said her mother. He's too small.
A pot,
shouted George in a loud, commanding voice. Dazedly, his mother put him on it, and he went. Chapter 6. Ordinary babies grizzle or yell when they're uncomfortable or hungry. George made sure, from now on, that his needs were met. He did it, quite simply, not by asking, but by giving orders. At any time of day or night, the cry,
A pot! A pot!
Was heard, and someone rushed to do his bidding. Also, he didn't wait long before beginning to order his own meals direct. To do all this meant further training for his parents. First, George dropped the parrot fashion trick of repeating what was said to him. To be sure, when his mother said, Good morning, he replied with those same two words, but then we all do that. However, when, as was her habit, his mother said, Who's a good boy? Because the baby always answered,
Good boy,
which made her go weak at the knees, George now replied,
I am, of course.
Oh, cried his mother in delight. What a clever little Ookie Pookie Bunny Wabbit.
Cut that out, said George sternly. And I want muesli and banana for breakfast.
From that moment, neither George's mother, from shock, nor George, with relief, ever spoke baby talk again. But it was still only to Laura that George revealed his full powers of speech and reason. To his parents he now spoke the occasional short sentence, almost always beginning,
I want.
In front of other relations, his grandparents, for example, he usually kept silent, either pretending to be asleep or perhaps favouring them with a gracious smile.
Aren't you a beautiful boy?
They might say. And George would reply,
Yes.
Oh, George speaks, they cried to one another.
But George had no intention yet of showing them how much.
I think my first birthday will be the right time,
he said to Laura.
Right time for what?
My maiden speech in the house.
I don't understand,
said Laura. George looked at her in a kindly way.
It's difficult for you, I know,
he said.
But the time is coming when I shall feel the need of adult conversation. Not that I don't enjoy talking to you, Laura. Don't think that for a moment. But there are a lot of things that you don't know much about. Politics, history, religion, the arts. Take writing, for instance. I'm beginning to get the hang of holding a pencil, but at present it won't make the marks I want it to. So I can't put my ideas down on paper yet. That'll come. But in the meantime, I'm getting very tired of limiting my gift of speech. So, on my first birthday, I'm going to hoist my flag to the masthead and show myself in my true colours.
I don't know what all that means,
said Laura.
You will do, dear,
said George.
When you're a little older.
In one way especially, George was exactly like every other normal, healthy baby. He loved his grub. As long as food was put in front of him, George would eat it. He differed, however, from other babies in being extremely choosy, and, of course, in having the power to make his preferences known. Not surprisingly, then, George had ordered the food for all the meals on his birthday, and had done so well in advance.
"My handwriting leaves a certain amount to be desired at present,"
he had said to his mother some days earlier.
"So, if you'll be good enough to fetch paper and pencil, I will dictate the menus to you."
"Yes, George," said his mother, and did as she was told.
"Now then,"
said George,
"let us begin at the beginning. Breakfast. It is most important to have a good lining to the stomach at the start of the day. It sets you up for the rest of it. Don't you agree, Mummy?"
Yes, George, his mother said.
"Right then,"
said George.
"I've been thinking about this during our recent visits to the supermarket. For instance, there's a brand of tinned creamed rice called Ambrosia. You know the meaning of that word, I presume?"
His mother shook her head. George sighed.
It means food fit for a god. Rather suitable, don't you think?"
"Yes, George."
"I'll start with a tin of that, and I should like it well laced with golden syrup."
"Yes, George."
"I have a sweet tooth, you see,"
said George.
"In fact,"
and he explored the inside of his mouth with a fat finger,
"in fact, I have 10 sweet teeth."
George's mother smiled proudly.
"Is that all you want for breakfast?" she said.
"Oh, goodness me, no, Mummy,"
said George, a trifle sharply.
"We're talking about meals for my birthday, remember? Special meals, not just the ordinary old humdrum food."
"Yes, George. What next, then?"
"Eggs,"
said George.
"Large, brown, free-range eggs, scrambled. Quite the most civilized way to eat eggs, in my opinion."
"On toast?"
"If it's done properly,"
said George.
"Not the way you and Daddy usually have it. Left to get cold and it comes out of the toaster, and then just a scrape of margarine on it. I want my toast spread while it's hot, so that the butter sinks into it. Plenty of butter, too. West Country Green Pastures is a good brand. And I shall need something to wash it all down with."
"Orange juice?"
"If you mean that stuff that comes out of cartons, no. Squeeze some fresh oranges, please. Smallish ones for choice. They're sweeter. And add a teaspoonful of demerara sugar. Now then, about lunch."
Lunch was to be easier for the cook, since George wanted his favourite lamb hot pot with chocolate pudding for afters. But his instructions for the birthday tea were more demanding. "There was to be jelly,
strawberry,"
said George, "and ice cream,
Neapolitan,
and banana custard and tin peaches and Swiss roll, and, of course, the birthday cake."
"I'll leave the actual ingredients to you, Mummy,"
said George graciously.
"But please be generous with the marzipan and icing sugar. And I'd like some of those pink roses on top. And don't forget the candle."
"Of course I won't,"
said his baffled mother.
"One candle,"
she thought.
"Can it be true that he's only going to be 1 year old? Will that be all, George?"
she said.
"Oh, I think so,"
said George.
"It's rather modest, I know, but then quality is more important than quantity, don't you think?"
Afterwards he told Laura what he'd ordered.
"I must keep my strength up, you see,"
he said.
"It's going to be a busy day. I shall have a lot on my plate."
"You certainly will,"
said Laura. Chapter 7. Soon it was the last day of March, the last day of the first year of George's life. During the previous 3 months, he'd revealed much more to his mother and father. He spoke to them at greater and greater length, and when he judged them ready, disclosed that he could read. So well trained had they become that when they said, "What would you like for a birthday present?" and he replied,
"An encyclopedia,"
they didn't even flinch. Now everything was ready for the birthday party the next day.
"George,"
his mother had said,
"would you like me to ask some other baby...
Children?
Certainly not, George had said. This party is for grown-ups, except, of course, for Laura. Grandparents, uncles, aunts, that sort of thing. I shall want to say a few words to them. Oh, they can have a slice of cake, and no doubt they'll expect endless cups of tea.
What would you like to drink, George?
Anything except milk.
Just think,
said Laura that evening when she came to say good night to George.
He was in his bedroom, practicing walking, something he'd only lately learned.
Just think, George, in the morning you'll be a whole year old.
I shall feel my age, said George. It's been a long time, but things should improve now that I've found my feet.
Oh, by the way, did you get me the present that I asked for?
Yes, said Laura.
A notepad and some felt pens, like you said. Though I should have thought you'd have liked a surprise.
I shall get enough surprises tomorrow from the relations, you'll find,
said George, somewhat sourly.
Rattles, cuddly toys, books with big pictures of C-A-T-S and D-O-G-S. At least your present will soon be very useful to me.
Laura lay awake a long time that night, thinking about her baby brother. Not that you can call him a baby, she thought. Or ever could, really.
I mean, he looks like one, but there's never been a baby as clever as George's.
How much he'd helped her.
No one else in her class knew all their tables right up to 12 times,
like she did.
No one else could add and subtract and share,
like she could.
And certainly no one was as good at general knowledge. Why, she knew how many legs a spider had, and what was the capital of France, and who wrote the Jungle Book, and who won the Battle of Hastings, and dozens of other things. All because George had told her. She remembered the dream she'd had when he was very small.
Oh, golly!
Wouldn't the headmaster be amazed at George now?
When she woke next morning, she couldn't think, just for a second, why she felt excited.
Then it came to her.
It was the 1st of April. It was George's birthday. At that moment, she heard her mother's voice calling her urgently. Laura put on her dressing gown and ran to find both her parents bending over George's cot.
What's the matter?
She said.
George doesn't look well,
said her mother in a worried voice.
He won't speak,
said her father.
We've called him, but he doesn't answer.
Laura looked into the cot.
George was lying quite still with his eyes shut. He was blowing very quickly and noisily through his mouth. Then, suddenly, he seemed to stop breathing, and his mouth closed, and his face began to go red.
Oh, George,
cried Laura.
Whatever's the matter? Speak to me, George, please. Say something.
All at once, George opened his eyes and his mouth and let out the breath that he'd been holding and burst out laughing.
Do you know what you lot are?
He said at last.
What?
They said.
April Fools,
said George happily. Chapter 8. George swallowed the last mouthful of scrambled egg and gave a loud burp. He smiled at his sister.
Do you remember, Laura,
he said,
when you used to hold me over your shoulder and pat me on the back to bring up my wind?
Laura nodded.
So much pleasanter,
said George,
when one can do these things for oneself.
Have you had enough to eat, George?
Said his mother.
Thank you, yes. An excellent breakfast, Mummy,
said George.
You are to be congratulated.
He turned in his high chair.
Daddy,
he said,
could I borrow your daily newspaper for a moment?
Of course you can, said his dazed father. Reading the paper, he thought, on his first birthday.
Come to think of it, said George, it'd be simpler if you could find the place for me and read it out. I find newspapers difficult to handle.
Which bit do you want, George?
My horoscope,
said George.
The section is called This Is Your Day, round about page 25. I'm Aries.
Aries, said his father. Let's see.
It says, you're under a lot of pressure today.
George burped again.
That's true,
he said.
But you carry more weight than you realize.
George looked down at his stomach.
Possibly,
he said.
And you will have everyone falling over themselves to make it a pleasant day for you.
Splendid, said George. Now, there should be a special item entitled, If It's Your Birthday.
Oh, yes, here we are. It says, You will grow in stature in the coming year. George nodded. You will take great strides forward. George nodded again. Your knowledge, wit, and wisdom will be the admiration of all.
Remarkable, said George. The fellow has me to a T.
For the rest of the morning, George practiced writing with his new felt pens and read his new encyclopedia, Laura turning the pages for him. Then, after his favourite lunch, he had a good rest to be ready for his birthday party. He went to bed and slept like a baby. At George's birthday party, everything was ready. All the guests had arrived, the four grandparents, and an assortment of uncles and aunts, including a large, jolly uncle newly home from abroad, who had never met George. They'd handed over their gifts, and now sat round the loaded table.
Oh, come on, everyone, said the large, jolly uncle. Let's sing Happy Birthday.
Excuse me, said Laura quickly. George doesn't want the singing yet. He wants to eat first, and then after he's cut the cake, you can sing.
Well, laughed the large, jolly uncle. And then what happens?
Then, said Laura, George speaks.
So they all ate, and then George cut the cake with Laura's help, and after that everyone sang,
Happy birthday, dear George! Happy birthday to you! Speech! Shouted the large, jolly uncle, winking at the others.
Then Laura wiped a mixture of ice cream and cake off George's face and took off his plastic bib, and George rapped with a spoon on the tray of his high chair, and all fell silent.
Ladies and gentlemen, said George, I'm delighted to welcome you all here today, and I trust you will forgive me if I remain seated. Standing up in a high chair is, you will agree, a dangerous business.
He paused and looked round at the circle of astonished faces. The large, jolly uncle gaped.
First, George went on, I should like to thank you all for the gifts which you have brought. I am sure you meant well. Next, I wish to thank my parents for the excellent meal which they have so kindly provided. And thirdly, I want to take this opportunity to say how grateful I am to my sister, Laura.
Laura blushed.
Without her understanding, support and affection, George continued, this past year would indeed have been a trying time for me.
He paused to take a sip of orange juice from his feeding cup.
For a long time now, he said, Laura has known of my personal good fortune, namely, the possession of intelligence beyond my years. Or rather, I should have said, beyond my year.
Ha, ha, ha,
said several voices nervously.
More recently, said George, my parents have also become aware that I am not, shall we say, as other babies are. But to the rest of you, it may have come as something of a shock. May I say, I hope the shock is not an unpleasant one. All of you are, of course, much older than myself. Some,
and he nodded politely towards the four grandparents,
very much older. You therefore have what I lack, namely, experience of the world, and I look forward to many interesting discussions with you on a variety of subjects. And now, if you will forgive me, I must leave you. Sleep is important at my age, and it has been a tiring day.
George bent forward in his chair in a kind of bow.
Once again, he said, thank you all for coming.
Laura looked round at the faces of the others. Her parents were smiling proudly. The grandparents, uncles and aunts sat bemused, scratching their heads or shaking them in disbelief, their eyes wide, their eyebrows raised. The large, jolly uncle looked as though he'd been hit with a sledgehammer.
Laura, said George, perhaps you'd assist me down from this high chair. How little he is, thought Laura, and how helpless still in many ways. Yet how clever to make such a speech.
She raised her hands and began to clap, and her mother and father joined in, and soon everyone was clapping. Then Laura lifted George down and held his hand as he walked, not too steadily, but with great dignity, out of the room.
"Thanks, Laura,"
said George later when she tucked him up in bed.
"And thanks again for the felt pens. I tried them out this morning. The pad is over there on the table. Have a look."
Laura picked up the notepad that she'd given him, and there, in big red capitals, were the words, "George Speaks."
"Golly, that's good, George,"
she said.
"And what a speech it was. Why, when you grow up, you could be anything you wanted. You could make speeches like that in Parliament. You could be the Prime Minister."
"That wouldn't get my vote," said George.
"Well, you could be a judge."
"The verdict is no."
"A brain surgeon, then?"
"Not on your life."
"An explorer?"
"No way."
Laura racked her brains to think of someone really important. There was the Queen, of course, but then she didn't see how George could become a king.
"I know,"
she said.
"You could be the Archbishop of Canterbury."
"For heaven's sake,"
said George.
"I don't want to be any of those things. I want to do something that's fun."
"Like what?"
Laura said. George yawned.
"I'll tell you a secret, Laura,"
he said.
"When I grow up, I'm going to write funny stories for children."
And you know, when George grew up, that's exactly what he did do. Would you believe it? Friends and Brothers.
"You say that word just once more," said William to Charlie, "and I'll hit you."
Charlie said it.
William hit him.
Charlie then let out a screech and kicked William on the shin.
And William bellowed.
William and Charlie's mother came rushing in like a whirlwind, with a face like thunder.
"You two will drive me mad,"
she stormed.
"All you do is fight all day long."
"William hit me,"
said Charlie.
"Why did you hit him, William?"
"Because Charlie keeps on saying the same word. Whatever I say, he says the same word over and over again. Anyway, he kicked me."
"Will hit me first,"
said Charlie.
"William," said his mother, "you are not to hit Charlie. He's younger than you and much smaller. The next time you do, I shall hit you."
"You didn't ought to, Mum,"
said William.
"Why not?"
"I'm younger than you, and much smaller."
"Absolutely,"
said Charlie.
"There you are,"
shouted William madly.
"That's the word. Whatever I say, he just says absolutely. He doesn't even know what it means."
"Absolutely,"
said Charlie. William let out a yell of rage and rushed at his brother with his fists clenched. Charlie dodged behind his mother, who held the furious William at arm's length.
"Now stop it, the pair of you," she said. "William, you stop attacking Charlie, and Charlie, you stop annoying Will. I can't stand one more minute of being shut in this house with you two. Get on your bikes. We'll go in the park."
William stumped off, limping slightly from the kick, and shouting angrily,
"It's not fair!"
From behind his mother's back, Charlie's face appeared. Silently, he mouthed the word,
"Absolutely."
In the park, William rode his BMX at top speed. He felt the need to be all by himself, miles from anybody. The roads in the park were full of steep switchback slopes, and William swooped down them flat out. Like a lot of elder brothers, he felt he'd had a raw deal. Charlie, meanwhile, was trying to see how slowly he could pedal without falling off. He'd not long inherited William's old bike, and was fascinated by the problems of balance. This was much more fun than a tricycle. Like a lot of younger brothers, he'd forgotten all about the recent row, and was singing happily to himself. Then he came to the top of one of the steepest slopes. He grinned and bent low over the handlebars. His mother, walking some way behind, saw the small figure disappear from view. A moment later, a dreadful wailing started her running hard. Halfway down the slope, Charlie lay sprawled in the road, the old bike beside him, one wheel still spinning. His face, she saw when she reached him, was covered in blood. There was a deep cut across his forehead, and a set of long scratches, gravel-studded, down one cheek.
At that moment, William came flying back down the reverse slope and skidded to a halt, wide-eyed with horror at the scene.
"What happened?"
he said miserably. "I don't know. He must have touched the brakes and gone straight over the handlebars. Listen carefully, Will. We must get him to hospital quickly. That cut's going to need stitches. I'm going to carry him to the nearest park gate, that one over there, and try and stop a car to give us a lift. Can you wheel both bikes and stick them out of sight in those bushes, and then run and catch me up?"
"Yes, Mum,"
said William. He looked at his brother's face. Charlie was still crying, but quietly now.
"He'll be all right, won't he?"
William said. 24 hours later, Charlie, recovered now from the shock of his accident, was jabbering away 90 to the dozen. He remembered little of the actual crash, or of his treatment in hospital, the stitching of the cut, and the cleaning up of his gravelly face. He was very swollen now, so that one side of him didn't look like Charlie at all. But his voice was as loud and piercing as ever, as he plied his brother with endless questions.
"Did you see me come off, Will?"
"No.
I went right over the handlebars, didn't I?"
"Suppose so."
"How fast do you think I was going, Will?"
"I don't know."
100 miles an hour, do you think?"
squeaked Charlie excitedly. "I expect so, Charles," said William in a kindly voice. "You looked an awful mess when I got there."
"Lots of blood, Will?"
"Yes. Ugh, he was horrible."
"Then what happened?"
Mum ran all the way to the nearest gate carrying you, and a kind lady in a car stopped and gave us all a lift to the hospital."
"And then they stitched me up?"
said Charlie proudly. "Yes."
"Did you see them stitching me up, Will?"
"No, Charles."
"I expect it was a huge great needle,"
said Charlie happily.
"You've never had 6 stitches, have you, Will?"
"No," said William. "You were jolly brave, Charlie," he said.
"You can have a go on my BMX when you're better." "I can't reach the pedals,"
Charlie said.
"Oh, well, you can take a picture with my Instamatic if you like." "Can I really, Will?"
"And you can borrow my Swiss Army knife for a bit."
"Can I really?"
"Yes," said William. He put his hand in his pocket and pulled out a rather squidgy-looking bar of chocolate. "And you can have half of this," he said.
"Gosh, thanks, Will."
William and Charlie's mother put her head round the door, wondering at the unaccustomed silence, and saw her sons sitting side by side on Charlie's bed, chewing chocolate. William actually had his arm round Charlie's shoulders.
"Look what I've got, Mum,"
said Charlie, with his mouth full. "Did you give him some of yours, Will?" said his mother.
"Naturally,"
said William loftily.
"We are friends and brothers."
Another day went by, and Charlie was definitely better. His face was much less swollen, his spirits high, his voice shriller yet. He made up a song about his exploits, which he sang endlessly and very loudly.
"Who came rushing down the hill? Charlie boy. Who had such an awful spill? Charlie boy. Who came down with a terrible thud, covered in mud and covered in blood? Charlie, Charlie, Charlie boy."
William, as he occasionally did, had an attack of earache. Painful enough without Charlie's singing.
"Charles,"
he said, as the friend and brother was just about to come rushing down the hill for the 20th time,
"do you think you could keep a bit quiet?"
"Why?"
shouted Charlie at the top of his voice.
"Because I've got earache."
"Oh," said Charlie in a whisper.
"Oh, sorry, Will. Does it hurt a lot?"
"Yes," said William, white-faced.
"It does."
For the rest of the day, Charlie tiptoed about the house, occasionally asking William if he needed anything, and if he did, fetching it. He guarded his brother's peace and quiet fiercely, frowning angrily at his mother when she dropped a saucepan on the kitchen floor.
"Hello, Charlie boy,"
shouted his father on his return from work.
"How's the poor old face?"
"Shh! Don't make such a noise, Dad,"
hissed Charlie furiously.
"We always got earache."
It was now a week since Charlie's accident, a week of harmony and brotherly love. Charlie's face was now miles better, and William's earache quite gone. They were drawing pictures at the kitchen table with felt pens.
"Charles," said William, "can I borrow your red? Mine's run out."
"No,"
said Charlie.
"Why not? You're not using it."
"Yes, I am,"
said Charlie, picking up his red felt and colouring with it.
"You just did that to be annoying,"
said William angrily. The word annoying rang a bell with Charlie, and he grinned and nodded and said,
"Absolutely." "Charlie,"
said William between his teeth,
"don't start that again or I'll hit you."
"You can't,"
said Charlie.
"I've got a bad face." "I'll hit you all the same,"
said William.
"I'll shout in your bad ear,"
said Charlie.
"And do you know what I'll shout?"
"What?"
"Absolutely!"
yelled Charlie, and scuttled out of the room with William in hot pursuit as life returned to normal. On the other hand...
"Will,"
said Charlie,
"what's the opposite of right?"
"What?" said William, who was busy reading.
"It's a really hard one, this, Will. What's the opposite of right?"
"Left," said William.
"Wrong,"
said Charlie. William put his book down.
"Don't be stupid, Charles,"
he said. He spread his arms wide, hands open, fingers outstretched.
"Look,"
he said.
"This one's right, this one's left. Opposites, see?" "But that's not the right answer,"
said Charlie patiently.
"I told you it was a hard one. The right answer's wrong."
William felt his patience slipping.
"How can the right answer be wrong?"
he said.
"Because wrong is the opposite of right,"
said Charlie.
"So is left." "Oh, I know that,"
said Charlie airily.
"But that's the easy answer." "Mum,"
said William.
"Yes?" "What's the opposite of right?"
"Well, it depends, Will. It could be left, or it could be wrong."
"You knew,"
said William glumly. Charlie, meanwhile, was quizzing his father, who was writing a letter.
"Dad,"
said Charlie.
"Yes?"
"What's the opposite of right?"
Charlie's father put down his pen and turned to face his younger son.
"Well, Charlie," he said, "there are several possible answers to that question. First of all, if you're talking about your hands or your feet or your eyes, you could say the opposite of right was left."
"Or your ears,"
said Charlie.
"What?"
"Oh, yes, or your ears. But on the other hand, if you were doing a sum, adding 5 to 5, let's say, then the answer 10 would be right and the answer 9 would be wrong."
"Or 8,
Charlie said. "What? Oh, yes, or 8. But then again, Charlie, there's a third answer to your question, you see."
"There is,"
said Charlie.
"Yes. Now, what am I doing?"
"Talking a lot."
"No, I mean, what was I doing when you started asking me?"
"Writing a letter."
"Exactly. Now, here's a third answer to your question. Ask it again."
"What's the opposite of right, Dad?"
"Don't write."
"Eh?"
"Yes, Charlie," said his father.
He took out a fresh sheet of paper and picked up his pen.
"Now," he said, "you say to me, right."
"Right,"
said Charlie. Obediently, his father scribbled away.
"Now,"
he said,
"say the opposite."
"Wrong,"
said Charlie. His father went on writing.
"Left,"
said Charlie. His father still went on writing.
"Oh, now I get it,"
said Charlie.
"Don't write."
And immediately the flying pen skidded to a halt. Charlie considered this. Then he said,
"Can I have that piece of paper, Dad?"
He went away and found himself a felt pen
and wrote on the paper in big red letters, R-I-T-E-L-E-F-D. R-I-T-E-R-O-N-G. R-I-T-E-D-O-A-N-T-R-I-T-E. Then he went to find his brother. He showed him the paper.
Look, Will, he said. There's three opposites. Dad showed me. There's another sort when you're writing a letter.
William read what Charlie had written.
Charles, he said scornfully, you spelt every word wrong. You're hopeless at spelling, hopeless. You can't even spell little short words like these. I'm only good at really long words, said Charlie. I could beat you at spelling a really long word. Don't be so stupid.
Charlie went away, his eyes narrowed in thought. He went to his bedroom and chose an animal book from his bookshelf and took it to the bathroom and locked himself in. He turned the pages till he found the picture of a particular animal and propped the open book on top of the lavatory system. Then, sitting the wrong way round on the lavatory seat cover, he copied carefully in small letters onto the small palm of his left hand, R-H-I-N-O-C-E-R-O-S. At supper time, Charlie said to his father,
Dad, why is a rhinoceros called a rhinoceros?
Well, said his father, the name comes from two old Greek words, rhinos, which means nose, and kyras, which means horn. Nose, horn, you see? An animal with a horn on its nose.
It's a long word, isn't it, Dad? Said Charlie.
William rose to the bait.
Charlie says he's only good at spelling long words, he said. I am, said Charlie. Well, go on then, said William. Spell rhinoceros.
Oh, come on, Will, said his mother. That's much too hard for Charlie. I don't suppose you could spell it yourself.
I bet I could.
Go on then.
All right, said William.
He began, and his mother and father laughed. You're wrong already, they said.
Can I try?
Said Charlie in a small, polite voice. Now it was William's turn to laugh.
Fat chance you've got of getting it right if I can't, he scoffed. I might, Charlie said.
Have a go, said his father. Yes, go on, Charlie, have a try, said his mother. Charlie rested his right elbow on the table and, with his right hand, scratched his head and frowned as though he was thinking very hard. His left hand was curved around his plate, the palm towards him. Slowly, pausing here and there as though for an extra effort of thought, he said,
R-H-I-N-O-C-E-R-O-S. Hooray!
Cried his mother.
Clever old Charlie!
Shouted his father. William's mouth hung open in amazement.
Did he get it right?
He said.
Yes,
they said.
He did.
Yes, said Charlie.
I'm good at spelling long words, Will. I told you. I was right, and you were the opposite. You do know what the opposite of right is, don't you, Will?
Snapdragon. Charlie had a pet beetle. It was quite an ordinary-looking beetle, except for its colour, which was a shiny dark red. Charlie, who was keen on gardening and knew the names of a lot of flowers, had found it climbing up an antirrhinum, so, of course, he called it Snapdragon. Snapdragon did not live up to his fierce name. He didn't bite or sting, and he allowed Charlie to take him to school in a matchbox and show him off. Even Charlie's teacher didn't know what kind of beetle Snapdragon was, which, combined with his colour, made him seem all the rarer and more remarkable.
"He might be the only one," said Charlie to William.
"The only one what?"
"The only one of his kind of beetle."
"Don't be silly, Charles," said William loftily. "He must have had a mother and a father, just the same as him."
"He might have come out of an egg,"
Charlie said.
"Well, eggs have mothers and fathers, don't they?"
"He might have been an orphan egg,"
said Charlie, turning away.
"Oh, don't be so stupid, Charlie," said William angrily.
"And I wish you'd shut up about your beastly beetle. I'm sick and tired of him."
William made a horrible face behind his brother's back, changing it quickly into a mad grin as Charlie turned round again.
"And I should think everyone else is fed up with him too," he said.
"I'm not,"
said Charlie, putting Snapdragon in his matchbox and sliding it shut.
"I think he's lovely."
"Well, no one else does."
"Yes, they do. Mandy and Laura do."
Mandy and Laura were in Charlie's class, and he particularly liked them. Usually, William did not tease his brother about this, but when he did feel like getting Charlie's goat, there was one sure way to do it.
"Oh, Mandy and Laura," he said scornfully. "Your girlfriends."
These words, William knew, drove Charlie into a wild rage, and now he rushed at William in such fury that he dropped the matchbox on the floor. Much later, when William and Charlie's mother had broken up the fight, William came back into the room and saw the box lying there. He picked it up and opened it. Inside, Snapdragon was quite still.
"Is he dead?"
William wondered. And he gave the beetle a little prod with his finger. Immediately, Snapdragon opened a pair of small, curved wings and flew out of the matchbox and out of the open window and away. William thought quickly. No good leaving the box wide open. It would be plain that he had done it. No use shutting it right up. How, then, could Snapdragon have escaped? Carefully, he closed it so as to leave a small gap at one end, a gap just big enough for a beetle to have crawled through, and put it down on the floor again. Then he slipped quietly out of the house and went to play with his friends Sam and Weasel. Luckily, it was William and Charlie's mother who picked up the matchbox and opened it and found it empty. Luckily, she came to the conclusion that William had hoped for.
"What must have happened, you see,"
she said to Charlie,
"was that when you dropped it, it slid open just enough for Snapdragon to get out. He's sure to be somewhere in the room. I'll help you look."
But though they searched everywhere, there was no sign of the escaped prisoner, and Charlie was very unhappy.
"I'll tell you what," said his mother. "When I make a cake for your birthday next week, I'll make a chocolate Snapdragon, a big one, to go on the top."
In the days that followed, William began to feel more and more guilty about Snapdragon. It would have been better, he felt, if someone had actually accused him, but no one had. He thought about confessing, but decided against it. Instead, he had a sudden, brilliant idea. There was a shop that he knew where they sold all kinds of small toy ornaments, mostly little models of animals in wood or pottery or glass. Some were made out of seashells stuck together, and one of these was actually a beetle. It had a big oval shell for a body, and a small round one for a head, and little twisty pointed shells for legs. It was even a reddish colour. It was also rather expensive, but William was determined to buy it for a birthday present for his brother. Then he wouldn't need to feel guilty any more. He unscrewed the plate in the belly of his piggy bank. As well as William and Charlie, there were seven other children at the birthday party.
"Who do you want to invite, Charlie?"
his mother had said.
"Mandy and Laura and Ruth and Justine,"
said Charlie. He stared beadily at William, waiting for him to say,
"All your girlfriends,"
and ready to attack him the moment he said it. But William kept silent. Charlie was so surprised at this that he began to feel a little guilty.
"You can ask someone if you like, Will,"
he said.
"Can I have Sam and Weasel?"
William said. Weasel was Sam's little brother. His real name was Oliver, but no one ever called him that.
And how about Hannah, Will? Said his mother. She's your girlfriend.
She's not!
Shouted Charlie angrily.
She's his friend!
And he stamped out of the room. William grinned happily. When Charlie opened his presents on the morning of his birthday, there was nothing from William.
Well, haven't you got a present for Charlie?
His parents said.
Yes,
said William.
It's a surprise.
Well, aren't you going to give it to him?
Later,
William said. The children sat round the table, staring at the big, oblong chocolate cake, and especially at the thing that stood on top of it.
It's a beautiful beetle,
said Hannah.
It's really lifelike,
said Sam.
It's just like Snapdragon,
said Mandy and Laura together.
Only miles bigger,
said Ruth.
At least 20 times as big,
said Justine.
Could I have a bit?
Said Weasel. William said nothing. His hand was in his pocket, holding something. Come on, Charlie, said his mother. You've got to cut the cake, and then we'll sing Happy Birthday. But I think I better take Snapdragon off first, hadn't I?
No!
Shouted Charlie.
I want to have him!
And he grabbed at the chocolate beetle so roughly that its head broke away, and its legs snapped off, and its body cracked into pieces. Charlie broke into terrible sobs. He wept bitterly, his head bowed over the broken bits of beetle on his plate.
Don't cry, Charlie,
said Hannah and Mandy and Laura and Ruth and Justine. And all those nearest to him patted him in a motherly way.
It's only chocolate, Charlie,
said Sam.
You can still eat it just the same.
Can I have a bit now?
Said Weasel. While they were all busy comforting Charlie, William took the seashell beetle out of his pocket and stood it carefully on top of the cake. He waited till Charlie's sobs had become snuffles, and then he said in a loud voice,
Happy birthday, Charles!
Oh!
Cried all the girls.
Look, Charlie, look what Will's given you. Isn't it lovely?
Oh, Will, said his mother. That really is beautiful. Look, Charlie, what do you say?
Still sniffing, Charlie looked up. There were tears on his cheeks and his nose was running, and Mandy and Laura, sitting either side, mopped him with paper napkins. Then Charlie reached out, slowly this time, and lifted the seashell beetle off the cake. He looked at it and managed a sort of smile.
Thanks, Will,
he said.
It's nice.
Come on, his mother said. Let's cut the cake. I'll help you. Sing, everybody.
And they all sang,
Happy birthday, dear Charlie. Happy birthday to you.
And so it was. Not Enough Cornflakes. It was the day of the marathon. The race was to begin in the park, not half a mile from William and Charlie's house, and the boys were going to be taken to watch the start. William was daydreaming over his cornflakes. He saw in his mind not the start, but the finish of the marathon. Huge, excited crowds lined the streets, cheering madly, one name on everyone's lips.
William! William!
They shouted.
William's in the lead! William's going to win!
And every eye was fixed on the bend where the runners would come into view as they entered the finishing straight. First, two policemen on motorbikes roared round the corner, followed by a police car, with its headlights blazing and its siren blaring,
Nina, Nina, Nina.
Then, at last, appeared the figure of a runner, quite alone, for he had long outdistanced all the other thousands of competitors. The figure was wearing... William took an absent-minded mouthful of cornflakes as he thought about this. Was wearing green shorts and blue and white trainers and a yellow T-shirt with black lettering on it. What did the lettering say? William chewed and swallowed, and suddenly he began to smile broadly. Will power. That's what the lettering said. And now he was nearing the finishing line, while all around the crowd went wild. He could hear them as he broke the tape, all yelling the same thing. William the Conqueror! They shouted. William the Conqueror! But then, gradually, the hundreds of voices became one voice, and that voice was a familiar, squeaky one.
William, you're bonkers,
Charlie was saying, peering round the cornflake packet.
William's bonkers, he said to his parents. I've been watching him, and first he was puffing and panting as if he'd been running, and then he started grinning all over his face, and then just now he raised both arms in the air. William, you're bonkers.
William glowered. I was thinking, he said. Well, think about eating up your breakfast, said his mother. Or we'll be late for the start of the marathon. And you too, Charlie. Stop reading that cornflake packet and get a move on. Charlie, though as yet not the world's best speller, was a good reader. While his brother had been dreaming, he'd been hatching a plan of action. And what he was reading on the back of the cornflake packet interested him greatly. It said, for energy, enriched wheat flakes. For stamina, sugar. For strength, iron. For vigour, vitamins C, B6 and D. Eagerly, Charlie began to eat. I don't know what's up with Charlie today, said his mother, as they made their way across the park, Charlie running ahead, William dawdling behind. You were reading your newspaper, so you didn't see, but he ate four helpings of cornflakes in the time it took William to finish one. Well, it doesn't seem to have done him much harm, said Charlie's father. Just look at him. Before them was a throng of people making their way towards the start of the marathon, and Charlie scampered madly about amongst them at top speed. He was wearing a red and yellow striped cap with a long peak, and he buzzed in and out of the forest of legs like a bee in a flower bed. Catching sight of his family, he came zooming back. You're full of energy today, said his father.
And stamina,
shouted Charlie.
And strength and vigour. Come on, Will, I'll race you.
Oh, get lost, Charlie, said William. That's just what he will get, said his mother, if he doesn't stay close to us. At the start line of the marathon, there were thousands of runners, men and women, youngish and middle-aged, and some quite old. Most wore singlets and running shorts, but there were lots of strange outfits, too. Some were dressed as waiters, carrying trays of drinks. Some were dressed in animal costumes. A monkey, a bear, a frog. There were two people inside a pantomime horse, and one spectacular entry, nine men forming a long green caterpillar. The watching crowd was so huge that it was not possible to get anywhere near the actual start. And when at last the starting pistol cracked and the ground shook as the army of runners set off on their 26-mile and 385-yard journey, William and Charlie's father hoisted William onto his shoulders so that he could see over the heads of the spectators. And William and Charlie's mother bent down to pick up Charlie. But Charlie had gone.
Charlie's gone, she shouted above the noise of the crowd. Oh, Lord, where on earth's he got to?
Forgetting the runners now, streaming past them, they were looking frantically around, when suddenly, from his high perch, William cried,
Look! There he is!
They looked, as the really good runners went racing away across the park, and they saw the not-so-good runners plodding past and the not-so-very-good-at-all runners approaching. These were followed by some waiters balancing their trays, and then by the monkey, the bear and the frog, which was hopping. Behind them trotted the pantomime horse, and behind the horse the nine-man caterpillar rippled along. But last of all, scuttling along as fast as he could go, came a very small figure wearing a red and yellow striped cap with a long peak.
"Charlie!"
yelled William in wild excitement as the smallest marathon runner went by, hard on the last pair of heels of the caterpillar.
people around took up his cry.
Good old Charlie!
The roar went all down the ranks of the crowd until at last the family caught up with the runaway, who had stopped, puffed.
Gosh, Charlie!
Panted William, for once frankly admiring.
You ran in the marathon!
I did, didn't I?
Squeaked Charlie excitedly.
How far do you think I ran, Mum?
His mother looked back across the park to the start line. About 385 yards, I should think, she said.
How much further have I got to go, Dad?
26 miles.
How?
Said Charlie.
He wouldn't get there till about tomorrow night, Charles,
said William.
How?
Said Charlie. He looked into the distance, where now there were no runners to be seen. Even the caterpillar had disappeared. Let's go home, said his mother.
It's tiring running the marathon, I should think, said his father.
That was the trouble,
said Charlie thoughtfully.
I didn't have enough cornflakes.
Happy birthday. It was William's birthday. One of the family customs was that on your birthday, you could choose your own special breakfast. William had chosen poached eggs. He was sitting at the table waiting for them, wearing the best of all his birthday presents. This was a chimpanzee mask. Not just an ordinary flat mask with two eye holes and a nose hole, but a very superior one. It was moulded in the exact shape of a chimpanzee's jutting face, and best of all, the lower jaw was hinged. When you opened your own mouth, a strap that fitted under your chin made the mouth of the mask open too. To top it all, there was a shaggy wig of coarse black hair. To William's father, coming into the room, the whole effect was horribly lifelike.
Ugh!
He said.
You look frightful, Will.
Now, what have you chosen for your birthday breakfast?
Who?
Said William, parting his jaws to expose two rows of large yellow teeth.
That's chimpanzee for poached eggs, said Charlie. Isn't it, Will?
Said William. He scratched his ribs and grunted with excitement, bouncing up and down in his chair.
Why are they called poached eggs, Mum?
Said Charlie. Well, you use this special kind of pan, said his mother, where the eggs sit in these little metal nests and are cooked slowly by the steam from the boiling water underneath. That's called poaching. This pan is a poacher. And these eggs are ready. Take off your mask, Will. You can't eat with that thing on.
Oh, Mum,
protested the chimpanzee. William... Oh, all right. But when breakfast was over, William went ape again. He was expecting his friend Sam, and he set Charlie on guard at the window. After a while, Charlie said,
He's coming, Will! Sam's coming down the road! And Weasel, too!
Hoo-hoo-hoo,
said William softly, and he hid in the hall. When the bell rang, Charlie opened the front door.
Hello,
said Sam. But before he could say anything else, a frightful creature leapt out of the shadows, shaking its hairy locks and snapping its fearful jaws and screaming the awful tearing screams of an angry chimpanzee. Sam took one look and burst out laughing. Weasel took one look and burst into tears. Once Weasel had been comforted, and he and Sam had been shown William's other presents, they all decided to go and play hide-and-seek in the wood at the bottom of the garden.
I'll be the first to hide,
said the chimpanzee,
because it's my birthday. Count to 100 before you come looking.
And he shambled away, with bent knees and arms swinging from side to side, so low that his knuckles almost brushed the ground. Once out of sight of the others, he found beside the path a leafy tree with low, spreading branches, and climbed into it and settled down to wait. When the seekers had reached 100, they set out together. It was a dull day, and the wood was rather dark and silent, and Weasel reached for Sam's hand. They followed the path on which they'd seen William set out, until, as they walked under a leafy tree with low, spreading branches, Sam suddenly hissed,
"Look out! Take cover! Get behind this tree!"
"What is it?"
whispered Charlie, as the three of them crouched behind the trunk of the tree.
"It's a poacher,"
said Sam.
"What's a poacher?"
asked Weasel in a shaky voice. Charlie patted him.
"It's all right, Weasel," he said. "It's only a special kind of pan for cooking eggs in."
"Shh,"
said Sam.
"He's coming this way. He's got a gun,"
Weasel whimpered. Down the path towards them came a big boy carrying an air rifle. When he reached the tree and saw the seekers crouching there, he pointed the air rifle towards them and said in a nasty voice,
"Push off, you kids!"
Weasel began to cry.
"It's not your wood,"
Sam said.
"And you shouldn't point guns,"
Charlie said.
"I'll do more than point it if you don't push off,"
said the big boy.
"I'll..."
But before he could say any more, there was a rustling sound overhead, and as he looked up, a frightful face peered out of the leaves above him and shook its hairy locks and snapped its fearful jaws and screamed the awful tearing screams of an angry chimpanzee. With a shout of horror, the big boy took to his heels and ran. Easily, as apes do, the chimpanzee swung down from the branch above and dropped beside them.
"That was fantastic, William,"
said Sam, grinning with delight.
"You were brilliant, Will,"
shouted Charlie, dancing with excitement.
"I want to go home,"
snuffled Weasel. But William did not yet feel ready to speak in his own language. With his brother and his friends, he shambled homewards with bent knees and arms swinging from side to side, so low that his knuckles almost brushed the ground. Every now and then he opened his great jaws to utter soft ape sounds of pure pleasure.
"Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo,"
said William on his happy birthday.
"Hoo-hoo-hoo."
Cry Wolf. William and Charlie were on holiday with their parents at an old cottage in the middle of nowhere. It was called Cock Robin Cottage, and all around it was a beautiful landscape of rocky hills and dales, down which flowed clear, cold streams. Every day, the family went out in the country and walked up the hills and down the dales and played by the streams. They met few people, but a great many sheep and cattle. By the end of each day, everyone's legs were weary, and the boys were, for once, glad to get into bed and have a story. Both William and Charlie were good readers, but there's something very nice about being read to when you're tired out. It doesn't have to be a brand new story. It can be one that you've heard loads of times, and a book that was a great favourite was Aesop's Fables. William preferred the more thoughtful tales, like The Dog and the Shadow or The Ass Eating Thistles. But Charlie liked his fables meaty, with plenty of beatings and bloodshed. The Horse and the Lion, for example, or The Kite, the Frog and the Mouse. They took turns to choose. "Your turn, Charlie," said his mother one evening. "Which one do you want?"
"The Ox and the Frog,"
said Charlie.
"Where the old frog explodes. Wham! Powy! Splat! Bits of frog flying all over the place."
"We had that," said William, "couple of nights ago." "Choose another one, Charlie," said his mother. Charlie cast about in his mind for a bloodthirsty story.
"I know," he said. "The Shepherd's Boy."
So their mother read them the story of the boy who looked after some sheep on a common and, just by way of a joke, kept running to men in nearby fields, yelling,
"A wolf! A wolf!"
And when at last they got fed up with leaving their work to help, only to find the boy was fooling, the wolf did come. And the boy cried, "A wolf! A wolf!" in earnest, and no one took a blind bit of notice. Charlie looked with pleasure at the picture in the book, which showed a huge black wolf chewing lumps out of a little white sheep.
"Serve the stupid boy right," he said.
And he sat up in bed and pointed his nose at the sky and made wolf howl noises.
"What about the poor old sheep?" said William. "You ought to feel sorry for it."
He thought of all the hundreds of sheep they'd seen that day. He looked out of the bedroom window and imagined them all lying in the darkness on the lonely hills.
"There couldn't be any wolves about nowadays, could there, Mum?" he said.
"No," said his mother. "The last British one was killed about 200 years ago, I think." She said good night and turned out the light. William was just getting sleepy when he saw his brother get out of bed and tiptoe to the window and peer out. Then suddenly Charlie scuttled back and leapt onto William's bed and grabbed him in mock terror, shouting,
"A wolf! A wolf! There's a wolf outside, Will!"
And William thumped him, and Charlie kicked William, and their father came upstairs and was very angry. Next day, as they set out from Cock Robin Cottage for a walk, William was busy working out a way to pay Charlie back. He was trying to think of other kinds of wild animals with which to frighten his brother. They walked beside the river, and William thought of crying out,
"A crocodile! A crocodile!"
But that didn't seem likely. They walked through a patch of very tall grass, just the place where a man-eater might lie in wait, but shouting, "A lion! A lion!" or "A tiger! A tiger!" wouldn't, he guessed, be much good either. He needed to think of a more probable animal that was also big enough and fierce enough. They came to a thick, dark wood and walked in among the trees. William thought about forests of old and what sort of creatures you might have found in them. Wolves, yes, but they were out. Deer, not scary enough. Wild boar? He tried saying, "A wild boar, a wild boar," quietly to himself, but it didn't sound right.
"Bears,"
thought William suddenly.
"That's it, bears. I'm sure there were bears in England once. There might be one or two left."
He dropped behind the others, and when they were some way ahead, he suddenly gave a scream and ran towards them with an expression of horror on his face.
"A bear! A bear!"
shouted William wildly. To his disgust, they all laughed.
"Is it the teddy bear's picnic?"
said his father.
"Is it Winnie the Pooh?"
said his mother.
"Has she got a bare bottom?"
said Charlie.
William laughed too. There wasn't much else to do.
"I'll think of something," he said to himself. "There must be something you could meet on a country walk that people are frightened of."
And just at that moment, they came out of the wood, and there, in front of them, was a herd of cows.
"Of course,"
thought William.
"A bull. Beware of the bull. Everybody's frightened of bulls. Well, they jolly well should be. That'll scare the pants off Charlie."
Once again he hung back. And when they were far enough away, he suddenly gave a scream and ran towards them with an expression of horror on his face.
"A bull! A bull!"
shouted William wildly. This time, because it was a more likely animal, they did actually look round at the peacefully grazing cows. But then they walked on again.
"Give it a rest, William," said his father. "Joke's over."
"Yes, do shut up, Will," said his mother. "You're spoiling the peace and quiet with all that shouting." As for Charlie, he simply said,
"Stupid boy,"
which annoyed William so much that he thumped him. Then, of course, William's parents got angry with him, and so, once again, he walked alone behind the others, scowling and muttering to himself. Two or three fields further on, there was another herd of cows. By the time William reached the middle of this field, a good 100 yards behind now, the grazing cows were quite close to him. And one of them in particular, a big red one with a white face, raised its head and stared at him as he scuffed his moody way past. Then it blew through its nose. William glanced up, and suddenly he saw that on the end of that nose there was a ring. As they neared the far end of the field, the others heard a scream and saw William running towards them with an expression of horror on his face, waving his arms and shouting wildly, "A ball! A ball!" This time, he did not stop when he reached them, but dashed past at top speed, making for the nearest gate. Endlessly he yelled, "A ball! A ball!" And before any of the others could say anything, they heard a loud snort behind them and saw a large red animal trotting purposefully towards them, swinging its heavy white head in a most unfriendly manner. "Phew!" gasped William and Charlie's father as they all lay puffing and panting in the grass on the far, safe side of the gate. "I haven't run so fast for years." William grinned. "Well," he said, "you can't say I didn't warn you." Try counting sheep. William and Charlie's mother closed the book. "Right," she said. "That was a long story. Now, into bed, both of you, and straight to sleep." William settled himself in the bottom bunk and watched Charlie's skinny little legs climbing the ladder to the top one. "Mom," he said in a moany voice. "What is it, Will?" "How can I go straight to sleep? As soon as you're out of the room, Charlie will start talking. He talks for hours." "Well, don't answer him." "I have to. He's always asking me questions." "It's because my brain is so busy," said Charlie from the top bunk. "I can't get to sleep because I'm busy thinking things." "Try counting sheep, Charlie," said his mother. "Just imagine a flock of sheep in a field, and one of them finds a hole in the hedge and hops through it. And then another one follows, and another, and another."
"That's four sheep," said Charlie.
"You don't stop there, Charles," said William scornfully. "You go on counting till all the sheep have got through the hedge."
"Well, how many sheep are there in the field?" asked Charlie.
"As many as it takes to send you to sleep," said his mother.
"Good night now. Sleep tight. Mind the fleas don't bite."
Charlie waited till the sound of her footsteps going downstairs had died away, and then he said,
"Will."
"What?"
"Why do I have to count sheep? Sheep are boring. I could count fleas, couldn't I?"
"Oh, count anything you like. Just shut up, that's all."
"Instead of sheep hopping through a hedge, I could count fleas hopping down from my bunk into yours, couldn't I?"
William began to scratch.
"You haven't got fleas, have you?" he said.
"No,"
said Charlie.
"But I haven't got sheep either."
"Don't be silly, Charlie," said William. "You don't have to have the things you're counting. You just imagine them. You can count anything you like."
"So I could count fleas?"
William scratched again.
"No, not fleas," he said.
"But you just said..."
"Oh, do shut up, Charlie. I want to go to sleep. Just think of some other kind of animal and count them."
"What kind?"
William sighed.
"Oh, I better suggest something," he thought, "or he's never even going to start counting."
He suddenly remembered a program on the telly about African animals, great herds of them stretching for miles and miles, plodding along, one behind the other, never ending.
"Try counting wildebeests," he said.
"What ye beasts?"
"Wildebeests," said William.
"What's a wildebeest, Will?"
"Well, they're sort of like a horse, the body is, but they've got heads more like a cow, with horns and a beard."
"The daddy ones have beards, do they?"
said Charlie.
"The mummies have beards too."
"Mummies can't have beards. Mummy hasn't got a beard."
"Well, she isn't a wildebeest, is she?"
"If she was,"
said Charlie,
"we be little wildebeests.
At least you would, Will. You'd be a wildebeest."
Why? What would you be?
I'd be a Charlie D Beast.
Oh, just stop being so silly, Charles, said William angrily, and try counting wildebeests. I want to go to sleep. I'm tired. For a few minutes there was silence. Then Charlie's face appeared, upside down, as he hung over the edge of his bunk.
Well, he said.
What now?
How can I count wildebeests if I don't know what they look like?
William, who'd been lying on his back, suddenly turned on his tummy and began to punch his pillow furiously with both fists. Then he got out of bed and switched on the light. He took an animal book from the bookshelf, found a picture of a wildebeest, and showed it in silence to his younger brother.
Oh, that, said Charlie. That's a gnu. They're the same animal, William said.
He closed the book, put it back on the shelf, turned out the light, and got into bed again. He said in a careful, patient voice,
Just try counting them, Charles. Just imagine you're in Africa, watching a huge herd of wildebeests walking past, thousands and thousands and thousands of them. You're sitting there, counting them, and the sun's blazing down, and you're getting very, very sleepy.
At last, above his head, William heard Charlie beginning to count. Quite slowly, quite quietly.
One, two, three,
he began. He'd reached 20, and William's eyelids were just beginning to droop when suddenly Charlie said, loudly and very fast indeed,
21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 20, 10. Charlie!
Cried William.
What are you doing? Not my fault, said Charlie. The wildebeests were walking quite slowly and then suddenly started to gallop. There must have been a lion about.
Again there was silence for a while, and then Charlie's duvet came whizzing down past William's head.
Charlie!
He said.
It's terribly hot in Africa,
Charlie said.
I'm thirsty. I'm going to get a drink.
He came down the ladder from the top bunk and went out to the bathroom. When he had climbed back into bed again, he said,
Will?
What now?
What comes after 99?
100, stupid.
And then 200?
No, of course not. You have to start again. 101, 102, said William. He pulled his duvet over his face and tried not to hear the steady murmur overhead as the count went on. Once more, he'd almost drifted off when Charlie said,
Well?
William did not answer.
If I keep quiet, he thought, perhaps he will shut up. Well, what comes after a million?
William sat up.
You can't have counted to a million,
he said.
I haven't. Not yet. I was just wondering. Charlie,
said William between his teeth.
Go to sleep. Can I stop counting?
I suppose so.
Okay,
said Charlie. For perhaps 5 minutes, William lay rigid, not moving a muscle. Above him, all was quiet. Tensely, he waited for the next...
Will?
It didn't come. Carefully, terribly carefully, William slid from under his duvet and swung his legs over onto the floor. Slowly, silently, he climbed the ladder to the top bunk and peered into it. By the light from the open door, he could see the still figure of his brother. Thumb in mouth, Charlie D. Beast was fast asleep. Cautiously, William climbed down again, picked up Charlie's duvet, scaled the ladder once more, and covered the sleeper up. What a thoughtful big brother a watcher might have felt.
but the only thought in William's head was of Charlie getting cold and waking up and starting up his endless questions all over again.
"Thank goodness for wildebeests," William said to himself as he settled down.
He looked at his watch. It was 9:30. The room was beautifully silent. Only an occasional small snore floated down from above.
"I wonder how many he did count," he thought. "I bet I wouldn't have to count as many as he did. It's just because he's small that he had to count for so long. I bet I wouldn't need to count more than a dozen."
He pictured in his mind a single wildebeest, starting at the back end with its long tail, the top part like a cow's, the lower part like a horse's, with a bushy whisk of hair. He saw its hindquarters sloping up to the high crest of its shoulders and the thick mane hanging down on either side of its long neck that ended in a huge head. A head too big for the ungainly body, with sharply curving horns and a great Roman nose and a bearded chin.
"Wildebeest number one," thought William.
He began to count. 500 wildebeests marched in single file past William before he realized that he did not feel in the least sleepy. Tired, yes, longing and longing to go to sleep, but much more wakeful now than when he'd begun to count. Suddenly he realized that it was not counting wildebeests that had eventually sent Charlie to sleep. It was stopping counting them.
"Can I stop counting?"
he had said. And almost immediately, he had slept. William stopped counting. He looked at his watch. It was 10:00. All around him now, as he lay open-eyed, were wildebeest noises. Everywhere he could hear their deep grunts and the rasping sound of their grazing and the swish of their tails as they struck flies from their flanks. He could hear the clash of horns as rival bulls met head to head and the distant thunder of hooves as part of the great herd raced about the African plain. Stopping counting didn't stop them coming on and on, more and more, in a great black, never-ending river of animals. Wearily, William looked at his watch. It was 11:00. Wearily, he dragged himself out of bed and stumbled down the stairs. In the kitchen, his parents were washing up before going to bed.
"Mom," said William in a moany voice, "I can't go to sleep."
"Isn't Charlie asleep, Will?" asked his mother.
"Yes, ages ago."
"I'll tell you the best thing to do, Will, shall I?" said his father.
"What?"
"Try counting sheep."
That was George Speaks and Friends and Brothers by Dick King-Smith. Read by Nigel Lambert.